Do you like wrestling trivia? Then check out the 5-Star Match Game, the pro wrestling quiz show. I'm Joe Gagne, and every episode, I grill 3 contestants with 5 rounds of power-packed wrestling trivia. We have over 30 evergreen episodes in the archives covering WWE, AEW, Japan, Mexico, and much, 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 much more. Play along at home and check it out today.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, gotta let it go. So Faster, freedom,
stars tonight.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate for February 18th, 2025. We are members of Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed on all podcast platforms and applications. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor of this podcast. You can set up a one-time or recurring donation. No obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joining alongside, as always, Case Lowe. And Case, I feel like we should just kind of get into it with the one thing that we kind of really want to talk off the top. Sadly, on the 15th, Gran Hamada passed away. And Case, you have a incredible obituary slash retrospective slash remembrance of Gran Hamada that you managed to, like a steamroller, get out that same day. So, bud, the loss of Gran Hamada just it hit me like weirdly, like it got me a little emotional, actually. Like, it felt like a distant relative of the wrestling that I like to watch passing away all of a sudden. Like, how did it feel like for you?
No, I'm in the same boat. You know, I had planned to start this show when I was thinking about it last week by springing some DDT recommendations on you, because we are in February of 2025, and I must admit I'm kind of into the DDT right now. But we will table all of that, because you're right. This is one that, you know, we haven't on this show for as many incarnations as Open the Voice Gate has had, and for as long, I mean, you and I have been doing this weekly for 5 years now. We haven't really had to talk about a lot of deaths. You know, yes, when something like Jay Briscoe comes up, you know, that happened as we were recording, and we obviously spent a large chunk of that episode talking about Jay Briscoe. But I say this knocking on wood and by no means trying to sound crass, but it is a little shocking that the Dragon system from Torimonda now has existed for as long as it has, and we really haven't had to confront death. It is something that miraculously, statistically, Dragon Gate has been able to avoid. And, you know, Hamada obviously only had, you know, a few appearances in Toriyama and then a few appearances in Dragon Gate, but he's kind of the godfather of the thing that you and I love most. And it was a strangely emotional passing, and it was one that I was ready for. You know, I was telling you before we started recording, there was the video of him that came out last week of him leaving the hospital. And I think both you and I have spent enough time around elderly people in our lives to know that was not a heroic exit from the hospital. That was that was somebody facing the end of the line. And it hit me at that moment that I knew I wanted to have something prepared for when he did pass. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of last week, and again, this is before we knew that he was going to pass on Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday of last week, I started cranking away at this article, because I wanted to have something ready. Now, my hope was that it could sit in my Google Drive for a little bit, that I could send it to you and get your input on it and send it around and try to get quotes from you know, whether it be Chris Daniels or Chris Hero. I reached out to my contact at AEW to try to speak to Jerry Lynn. I'm waiting to hear back on that. But, you know, my hope was that I could sit on this for a while and make it even more expansive than it was. And then, as I was telling you, you know, Saturday morning, I woke up and was like, man, I should really get back to that Hamada thing. I should try to finish that, because I was kind of right at the start of Universal. And so worked on it all morning, went to take my dog out. And then in the 15-minute break that I took to walk the dog after working on the article all morning, I found out that he had passed. And so the last, you know, few paragraphs of that were written rather quickly at that point. And then thank you to Rich at Voices of Wrestling for getting that up. But, you know, I do think he has become this show's mascot. I don't know if that's the appropriate word, but for the last 5 years, because it really goes back to you, me, and Alan spending a considerable amount of time on Hamada for the 2021 Greatest Wrestler Ever podcast that we did, it was my foray into really diving into Hamada, and you and Alan had a bit of a head start on me, but that was one of the guys that we spent a ton of time on those Pro Wrestling Torch podcasts talking about. And ever since then, you know, it's been Observer Hall of Fame conversations and the Lucha Resu tree and trying to put all those pieces together. And yeah, it was an emotional one. I think just because it directly impacts the people that care the most. You know, it's not one of those where your Reddit type users are going to be greatly affected by it. But as you saw from the outpouring of support from the wrestling community, you know, with both wrestlers and journalists alike, the people that were aware of Hamada, I think were pretty stung by this one. This was, you know, something that we all saw coming, but still nevertheless a very sad situation.
Yeah, and I feel like, at least for me, with Hamada, and at least the more I watch him and the more footage that kind of gets rediscovered, or sometimes you find the right YouTube channel and you find, wow, you get this another great match from Toreo or something like that. And it just became like more and more clear as I started like getting into him. And I think some of this is also a realization of me at like my age. Like, I could not have like followed Hamada just because of our age. We never got an opportunity to follow him in the current day. Like, we just didn't have that opportunity. That as I went back and as we started doing it, I used to always say that like, if I wanted to get time travel and it dropped into a time of wrestling, it would either be like drop me in Kobe in 1996, or also take me back to DFW in 1980. The more I got into Hamada and through the project with Alan, and even like through like our episode we did with Cubs fan last year, it became very clear to me that I was wrong before, that the person whose career I would have loved to see all in real time and in person case would have been Hamada's. I'd rather have gone to Toreo in the 70s and be able to see some of the Rene Gallardo stuff that sadly, and you mentioned this in your article, like the why did this not ever make tape, and his feud with Rene Gallardo is definitely one of the ones that I would have loved to have been able to see in person in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm at in my current level of fandom, is just the last, I would say, year and a half, I've really tried to dedicate myself to learning more about the history of Lucha, partially because, and I don't say this in an ignorant way, but when you follow Japanese wrestling as closely as like you and I do for a decade, it's not that you can't learn anything new, but the beats to history are ingrained in you at that point, and there's not a ton of room for discovery. Now, of course, you know, there's a giant All Japan Women blind spot with me and a giant FMW blind spot with me, but there was something about Lucha that became super enticing because it was a world entirely unknown, and Hamada was a big reason that I wanted to make the jump into understanding that sort of stuff. And yeah, I look, you know, whenever Roy Lucier posts an old UWA poster from the 70s or Cubs has any insight on it, it is to me the thing that has become the most interesting in wrestling and wrestling history, especially because we have so little of it, you know, especially 70s UWA footage. It is almost entirely non-existent, and it's this red hot promotion that, you know, existed at the same time where we have a full All Japan library and a full New Japan library, and obviously North American wrestling, while some promotions and some territories are spotty at that point, we still have a basic visual history of all of that, and it just doesn't exist in Mexico despite business being through the roof, which I find to be so interesting. But, you know, as we talk about Hamada, and I'm sure as we go along here I'll reiterate some of the points that I wrote about in the article over at voicesofwrestling.com, which for those that have not read it, it is the life, career, and enduring legacy of Grand Hamada, which
sure
is up there.
In the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, it's something I'm proud of. I really appreciate the response to it because I didn't realize when I started working on it last week that it was going to be published as soon as it was. I was obviously hoping that it would sit, like I said, in my Google Drive for a long time, but that's just not the case. But the response to that has been very flattering. I appreciate everybody that's read it and shared it and has said nice things about it. But when we talk about the influence of Grand Hamada, and I think everybody would say the same thing, that, oh, he was so ahead of his time. Oh, he, you know, he's a trendsetter, he's a trailblazer, he was this and that. I don't know if it gets contextualized enough that Hamada applied to the JWA dojo. So that means 1971 is when wanted to start his pro wrestling career. Now, I talk in the article about how, you know, he was rejected because of his size. The future Mr. Pogo was accepted. Hamada would have to wait a year. And then with his judo background, he was able to get into the New Japan dojo once that was launched. But I don't think people grasp that ideology enough that a guy who has roots in Showa era Japanese wrestling, again, JWA, is the guy that we credit for essentially inventing the Dragon Gate style. And that is, you know, my first big picture thought on Hamada is just, we all know he's ahead of his time. We all know that he was doing things in 1980 that would hold up on TV in 2025. I don't think people realize just how far ahead of his time he was at various points in his career.
And at the same time, yeah, he's absolutely, I mean, you look at what major pro wrestling is in North America and the style, and really what cemented it was 2019 with AEW and the Bucks bringing that kind of style towards television. But you started to see it in WWE, especially in that stretch of trios that they would have in the Shield days. But I think the thing that is worth kind of hammering home, and you do this in the article, it's not just that Hamada was ahead of his time and that you could link him all the way back to Ricky Dozen, basically. Like, when Case is inferring that about JWA, for those who don't necessarily get that, it's almost to the start of Japanese pro wrestling as a form. Like, he has a basis to it from like that point. But then within 4 years of the JWA, he gets rejected. He gets invited into New Japan, but they basically say, you're too small, you go to Mexico. Within 4 years, he's headlining UWA and having 10,000 seat buildings in Plaza del Toro. So it's not just that he was ahead of his time, and this is something that we got a good chance to talk a good deal with Cubs fan. He was a star of his time almost immediately within his career by the time he got into Mexico and into UWA.
Yeah, I'm so happy we did that podcast with Cubs when we did. And that's in our archives, Open the Voice Gate, this podcast feed. If you go back to, it would have been either October or November. And it's also linked on our Twitter. We both reposted it after he passed away. But you, me, and Cubs did about a two-hour show on largely the drawing resume of Hamada, which is the thing that I hope changes as we head into Observer Hall of Fame season this year. Not to make this an Observer Hall of Fame show, but I think with a majority of the voting base, and by the way, you'll enjoy this, zero mentions of Hamada's death on the F4W board outside of when Dave mentioned it on Observer Radio, which is super funny. It just goes to show the F4W target audience right now. But,
yeah.
I think a perceived bias against all junior heavyweight candidates, whether it's fair or unfair. But because of the way that we talk about Hamada as a wrestler, it seems to negate any conversation about Hamada as a star. And again, a lot of his drawing resume is done where at the best we have, you know, black and white photos of it and certainly no video of it. So I get that there's a bit of a hurdle there, but if you're voting at the Observer Hall of Fame, you should be able to get over that hurdle. But we talked
about newspaper reporting too.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the work that Cubs has done and Fredo Esparza has done and Rob Viper to some degree and Steve Sims, you know, there's historical records out there that should be looked at and should be taking into account that, yeah, you're exactly right. Hamada was a star. We talked a lot about that with Cubs. The thing that hit me as I was writing about his career in chronological order was you have the UWA in Mexico in the 70s where Hamada gets in right at the start of this promotion that changes Mexican wrestling into essentially kind of becoming what we know of it now. You know, heavy on trios action, with an emphasis specifically in Monterrey on hardcore matches and brawling and things like that. And Hamada is in the thick of it and is as good of a worker in the records that we have, those firsthand accounts from the time, as anybody in that promotion. You know, him and Perro Aguayo, sort of the stars of that promotion in terms of the work rate that they brought to the UWA. So between the UWA in Mexico in the 70s, and then Universal, his own promotion from 1990 to 1994 in Japan, and then his run in Michinoku Pro from 95 to, you know, we'll say, I, you know, my my cutoff on Michinoku Pro as the Michinoku Pro is through J-Cup 2000. So 95 to 2000, you know, when Hamada's there, he is a vital part of three different revolutionary promotions. And I think, you know, the UWA, we've talked about that. Michinoku Pro to some degree speaks for itself, although I want to talk about him and Michinoku Pro. But, you know, when you go back and watch the Hamada Universal footage, and if you haven't read the article, I've got 10 linked Hamada matches from his own promotion that I think everybody should watch. But you compare that to the ecosystem in Japan in 1990, where you have All Japan essentially modernizing a retro style. And look, you're not going to find me saying a bad word about 1990 All Japan. I obviously love that era and that promotion, and it's, you know, it's so wonderful. You have FMW, who's just getting off the ground and is kind of doing, in the same way that Universal was doing, hey, we're bringing Mexico to Japan, you know, FMW is bringing Memphis to Japan. And then you have New Japan, who in 1990 is coming off of an incredible 87, 88, 89 run, and not quite into the 93, 94, 95 run. New Japan's good. I would not call them great in 1990, at least from the footage that I've seen. So what you have is Universal essentially being the most forward-thinking promotion there is in Japan. Now, you could argue that Baba's booking in 1990 specifically, he had more foresight than anybody else in the country. But in terms of the in-ring style, you know, we're talking about the start of Sasuke and the start of Delphin and the start of Gato and Jado, and then in 91, Togo comes in. And it's just, it's amazing to think that this guy who started wrestling in 1972 and, you know, realistically is good through the early years of the 2000s, there are three different times in his career in three different promotions in which you could say that Gran Hamada was not only involved, but was vital to the cool thing going on in wrestling, the hip thing, the trendy thing going on in wrestling. And there are not many people that have that on their resume.
Yeah, and it's not just like the fact that he was there and at the forefront. You would see his fingerprints on these wrestlers who then would then go, and then you would have Sasuke with Michinoku Pro, you would have Ultimo later with Toriumon and Dragon Gate, and Jado and Gato in their own right. You essentially have this guy that, if as such a strong college football fan I am, Case, well, one of the big things in American football is, of course, the coaching tree, mm-hmm. right? You have a guy who not only did he have his representation within UWA, within ULL, and within Michinoku Pro, you have a guy that then, from the starting point in 1990, is able to basically have these, not all necessarily student, but people under his tutelage that over the next 35 years up till this day end up being some of the most prominent power players within Japanese pro wrestling.
Yeah, it's again, it's a career unlike any other. We're lucky that we have the footage we do, where, again, the bulk of the Hamada footage that we have is from 1990 to about 2001, where, again, he really tails off after that. I will say I watched a Hamada and Ultimo versus Sasuke and Delphin tag match from Osaka Pro in 2007 today. Disappointing. Was really hoping I was going to discover this late-stage Hamada gem. It was not quite that. But, you know, we have basically the last decade of his career is a lot like Nick Bockwinkel, where we have the last decade of his career is what we have on tape, which is a bummer because you think about, oh my God, he wrestled for 20 years before we have the bulk of his footage. And the crazy thing about Hamada is that he spends, you know, the 70s and 80s in New Japan and All Japan. And we know that in some warehouse somewhere, you know, there's these
Asahi or Nippon TV have.
Yeah, because the thing with Hamada and All Japan, especially, so he works there in 84 and 85. We have one match of him of his on tape, and it's, you know, him against the Guerreros, which is phenomenal. But Alan pulled in the Discord, there's a Hamada and Kawada tag against the Brazos, and it was from a Budokan show, so it was filmed, and we don't have any of that. And it made me think about, you know, in 2021, we were the greatest wrestler ever. I had Amato ranked at number 42. So ahead of him in terms of like 41 through, I think, 38, I had Masato Tanaka, AJ Styles, and Yoshihiro Takayama. And then directly behind him was Shijiro Otani, Manami Toyota, and Roderick Strong. And we're doing that off the back of the Michinoku Pro stuff, the Universal stuff, the very limited New Japan and All Japan stuff we have, and whatever Mexican footage exists, which is largely UWA in 1992. There's a chance that this is an even better wrestler than we realize. Forget about the Mexico stuff, which was game-changing in its own right, but just if we had more of that New Japan archive or more of that All Japan archive, it is one of the many what-ifs we have in Hamada's career, and I have a few more, but if you have anything to say about the footage that we have of Hamada, and sadly the footage we don't have of Hamada, please go ahead.
Do I have comments on media preservation? So here's my, I have not really looked super deep into either the situation behind All Japan and New Japan, at least as it relates to like that kind of thing. What I do know is that by the time that they were shooting, when Hamada was in All Japan, at least, Japan was already on beta, and that within like the TV studios there, by and large, have better archiving than other places at that time. There was not, I've never heard of a Japanese promotion taping over a tape, you know, like whereas you would hear that in the 70s and into the 80s within United States promotions, especially ones that did their studio shows at TV networks. They love to tape over tapes, and that's because at that time a studio broadcast Betamax or a 3/4 inch U-matic tape could cost like upwards of $40 to $50, and that era's money.
Well, so, I mean, think about it. We don't have like the first 10 years of Johnny Carson because it was all taped over for other Johnny Carson.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, the same situation is a bigger deal within the UK with Doctor Who episodes. That like what they have is basically, case there was a process called kinescopes, which is basically recording a TV, a TV playing it from like a studio feed, basically.
Wow.
That like happened. And is that to say that like all of these undercards from Budokan and all this are available probably somewhere? Maybe. I'm not saying that it's not, but I'm saying that the chances are a lot better that that footage would be at least existent of that era than the condition of what footage might be found out of from like if someone found like UWA film footage from the 70s. And right now in 2025, I'm a lot more confident about the All Japan stuff than I am about that, basically.
Yeah, I feel like, unfortunately, on the New Japan front, they made, there's like 6 Grand Hamada matches on New Japan World, and they made all of them free. And that, to me, felt like the olive branch they were going to extend us, that they didn't have a warehouse full of Hamada matches that they could upload. It was just going to be that, which, you know, I wrote about this in the article, but he spends the first 3 years of his career, basically before he goes to Mexico, he's wrestling Tetsumi Fujinami on almost every single show, and they have, you know, like 100 singles matches together, and we have zero of that footage. And that's especially a bummer because Fujinami, we actually have a large collection of 70s footage of from him in America and in Canada, and I think even the UK a little bit, and then obviously Japan, but we don't really get Hamada until 1979. So there's just a swath of Hamada versus Fujinami matches out there that we've never seen.
And I would say about the difference between the 70s and the 80s case, there's a good chance that a lot that those Fujinami versus Hamada stuff in the early 70s did not make tape or was not filmed. Like, that's just the reality of that. When tapes became, when broadcasting moved much more towards magnetic tape, that's when you would probably have more of a influx of things being filmed. I just don't think early 70s is likely.
Yeah, unfortunately you're right, and it goes to one of these great what ifs. You know, obviously what if we had more of his footage, but as you follow his career, you know, he's essentially aligned almost the entirety of his career with, you're going to have to remind me of his first name, which Shinma is he aligned with for most of his career?
It's the senior.
Yeah, Shinma senior, people will know. It's because Shinma Jr. is the money backer behind Universal, but before that, he's with Shinma, who is essentially
Hisashi Shinma.
Thank you, Hisashi Shinma. So, for those that don't know, he's one of the more interesting figures, I think, in wrestling history. He makes Inoki what Inoki became. He was the guy he was the guy that was able to maximize that insane charisma with the insane ideas and then make them happen. He's one of the great architects behind the Ali versus Inoki fight. he gets ousted from New Japan in an embezzlement scandal where he's the fall guy. You know, he essentially takes one for Inoki in 83. And so he's the guy that starts up the original UWF. And what I didn't realize until I started looking at it this past week was that Shinma starts the UWF, which explains why Hamada jumped there. Because I always thought it was weird that Hamada and Perro Aguayo were on the first UWF tour, which is, you know, Maeda and all, you know, and
right, yeah,
the UWF roster. So I was always like, man, that's I historically I don't know why Hamada and Aguayo were on that tour. And then I realized that Shinmo was the backer at the time. And then after that first tour, the roster wanted the old Tiger Mask Satoru Sayama, and Sayama's camp was like, cool, we'll come, but you have to get rid of Shinmo. We want control of this promotion.
Because Sayama and Shinmo had heat dating back to the Tiger Mask days.
And so the UWF roster threatens a blood oath if Shinma doesn't resign. And so he obviously gets out of there. And as we would learn between his failed attempts at the UWF and then at starting FMW, which I'm going to talk about in just a second, and then later on, all Shinma seemed to want to do was create this promotion that was part shoot style, but really more so hybrid fight of like, what if we take a wrestler against a karate fighter, and part heavy lucha influence, because yeah. Shinma was the point guy for New Japan and the UWA. He's the point guy for all things Inoki, and that was the original vision for the UWF, which just lost due to time because Sayama came in and said, we're creating full on shoot style. That's what this promotion is going to be. And Shinma lost all of his influence. He ends up, I think, in All Japan as an office guy in All Japan, which is why Hamada is there in 84 and 85. But you have to go like, oh man, if Sayama doesn't come in, all of a sudden we have, you know, maybe the UWF doesn't become anything, maybe, you know, but then again, Sayama's UWF flames out in a year. But it's another one of those things where, hey, they had steady TV and plenty of footage and also a hardcore fan base where there's a lot of handhelds out there of the UWF. And Hamada's gone after the first tour. We get the one Paraguayo match that doesn't fit in at all on that show. And then Hamada's gone once again.
Yeah, and it's interesting how the Shinma family then kind of still remain involved. His son is the person behind, was the money behind Universal Lucha Libre, and then you also have SWS that then bleeds into WAR, and then by the time you're talking about that, you're getting into basically Toriumon prehistory with these people. And it's one of those things that I think, like, Hizashi Shinma, I mean, he's still kind of, well, I know that there is one promotion that brought him out of wherever he was a couple months back, but he remains to kind of be like this vestige of Inoki in a way. And it makes so much sense that his idea of UWF was basically like, okay, Maeda, you're Inoki and you're going to beat up a bunch of foreign mixed martial artists.
He wanted to do basically early 80s New Japan with Tiger Mask. You know, that's probably the closest we have. And it made me, writing about Hamada in this instance, made me want to go back and really spend time on whatever New Japan Classics footage we have of that, like, 81 to 83. Because I admittedly, Sayama is actually a huge blind spot for me. I really don't have a ton of knowledge of the Tiger Mask run. And the, you know, everything that comes after. It's a fascinating guy that I don't know a ton about. And I'm trying to figure out if essentially Shinma, you know, not only has the UWF debacle, but I tell this story in the article, but there became this pact that was basically Shinma and Onita and Hamada and a few other guys that saw that independent wrestling was coming to Japan. It's not really a thing until the late 80s with Ryuma Go, one of Tetsumi Fujinami's great opponents in the 70s. You know, he holds the first independent show in 1988 in Korakuen, with I think he wrestles Onita on that show. And then in 89, they start hosting, they host this hybrid fight event that is Onita versus, I think, Matsushi Aoyagi is the guy's name, a karate fighter who ended up doing stuff with Onita later on at the start of FMW. But Shinma's once again involved in that, and at the FMW press conference where they're supposed to announce the promotion, Aoyagi does an angle with Onita where he blindsides him at the press conference, kicks him in the face, and Onita, without telling anybody, used a blood capsule because all the Japanese press was there, so they're all getting photos of him. You know, it was sort of the evil genius that was at Tsuchiya Onita, where now he has this great, incredible, bloody image for a group of Japanese media that was already, one, very pro-Onita, and two, was excited about a new promotion coming to Japan, because this is at the start of the indie boom. It's not like Japan's burnout on any promotions at the time, but Onita creates such a scene that the hotel that Shinma booked for the press conference gets pissed at Shinma, and he has to pay all these damages, and so they split from Onita. But really, everything that happened in Universal was supposed to be under the FMW umbrella, because they had Hamada on board and they had Asai on board, who would later become Ultimo Dragon. Those guys were supposed to be FMW wrestlers, and then the press conference goes so wrong that Shinma pulls out, and then a few months later, Shinma's son ends up being the money backer behind Universal, which then creates another weird thing when you talk about Hamada footage, where, you know, Universal is a gift because it really provides us with some of the best footage of Perro Aguayo and Los Fantasticos and Los Cowboys and Tejano and Silver King. And, you know, that even though a lot of guys were at this point reaching post prime, the core guys of the UWA, you know, the El Torero era that we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, a lot of their best footage actually comes from Japan and comes from Hamada's Universal. The bummer is that Hamada is tied, obviously, to the UWA up until that promotion goes away in 1994. And so by that point, he misses the television boom. You know, we have, and we'll talk about your match in just a second here, we have 1992 UWA TV footage that Roy Luchier has luckily tracked down, and we have quite a bit of that. But I don't know if there's more UWA TV out there that just hasn't been recovered, or if 1992 was really the only year they had proper TV.
Yeah. One thing that I think, interestingly enough, kind of happened was this week there was the passing of Alcatraz.
Yeah.
Who is the brother of the founder of the promotion that would become UWA, and he was kind of instituted in there with it. And at least from what, like, a lot of this comes from Cubs fans' article about the post about Alcatraz, UWA was so late onto TV at that time that I think 92 might have been like the start and very quickly the end of UWA TV with that.
Yeah, because a lot of the UWA footage that we had is Japanese commercial tapes when people realized that the Japanese fans were willing to pay a lot of money to see any UWA footage. The earliest Viano 3 footage we have is from 1984, and it is on a Japanese commercial tape. And I think the Santo Brazo mask match from 91, which is fucking awesome if you've never seen it, I think that it's UWA 91.
I think UWA TV
is, okay,
at some points is there, but it's not like 93. I've not been able, and it might be Roy's channel. They do not go very deep into 93, but that also could be Roy's availability.
Yeah, I certainly don't remember seeing any 1993 footage. So, but with Hamada, you know, he's now betting on an injured horse, essentially, because he's stuck with UWA because he's running his own promotion in Japan. As UWA goes, or I'm sorry, as Hamada's Universal goes along, that roster gets thinner and thinner because all the UWA guys are jumping to EMLL, or after 92, they're jumping to AAA, and Hamada can't because he's stuck representing what, you know, this promotion that for all intents and purposes just would not die until the early days of 1995, and his own promotion closes in 1994. And it's a real what if, because Hamada could have ended up in EMLL in 1992 with Negro Casas and Atlantis, and, you know, could have had a whole other career of footage that way. Or, you know, with his relationship with Perro, he could have been on the ground floor of AAA, and it's just his own promotion that halts him from doing that, which is, I'm happy we have 1992, 1993, 1994 Hamada's Universal, but it's not the same. You know, it greatly impacts what could have been of his career in Mexico at that point.
Yeah, and I think, like, when you start, like, looking at that, you also have the fact that what led to Hamada's Universal failing? Well, you had the introduction of AAA. You had Antonio Pena leaving the EMLL office, bringing up people, and then EMLL having to basically restart their office and go there down their past. You have Universal happening where essentially at a certain point, the man who would be known as Great Sasuke looks around and says, oh, we should be doing this regionally, guys. Let's all go up to my home prefecture and do this instead. So everyone is walking out around it.
Well, and for those that don't know, the history of Hamada's Universal, just really quick, if you have any foundational understanding for Dragon Gate USA, it is eerily similar to Hamada's Universal, where
almost
you look
beat by beat.
It's incredible. And for the same length of time, essentially.
Yeah, because we're talking about like 5 years, essentially.
Because if for those that don't know, like, okay, the first Hamada's tour, I'm going to pull it up right here to get a list of the Mexican towns that are on this tour. But in 1990, in Hamada's Universal, it's Pero, and it's Santo, and it's the Brazos, and it's all the star. It's, you know, Fuerza Guerrera at a young age is on those early tours, and obviously it's a Psy, but it's the biggest. It's Kendo, and it's Black Man, and it's Blue Panther, and it's Kaito Kung Lee. Like, it's Negro Casas is on those early tours. It's loaded in the same way that if you look at the first year of Dragon Gate USA, it's Shima and Shingo and Yoshino and Doi and Yamato and Hulk and Susumu and all the guys that you would want. And as time goes on, you know, for Hamada, like we just said, you know, he's losing guys to a promotional war happening in another country, and then he's kind of held hostage by his own promotion, whereas it was more, you know, I think an economic factor that took down Dragon Gate USA. But you start to look at 1992 and 1993 Universal, and look, those shows are still really, really good, but it's way more Monkey Magic Wakita, who would become Super Delvin, and Masa Michinoku, who would become Great Sasuke, and Gato and Jado and guys like that. And the talent just changes, and the atmosphere changes, because, you know, it's funny we're recording this as Fantastica Mania is about to start, because, yes, CMLL Japan was a thing from 97 to, like, 2001, and there's I've actually gone through that footage. There's some enjoyable stuff there, but Hamada's Universal is the predecessor for Fantastica Mania. You know, the whole goal of that promotion was, we are bringing Mexican wrestling to Japan as it's meant to be consumed. And, yeah. And it was up until Asai leaves, and Asai leaves in the fall of 1991, up until Asai leaves, it is a business success in Tokyo. Now, your mileage may vary, you know, in Osaka and Nagoya and places like that, they were never able to really draw in a huge way, but it was a Cork and Hall staple and a Cork and Hall sellout, with super, super hot crowds up until Asai leaves. Now, the funny thing about Asai leaving is that, and I referenced this in my article, but Asai had heat with the younger Shinma, and I'll quote from my own article here. Frustrated with the fact that the promotion was running small buildings, his salary had not increased despite his popularity, and by the fact that Asai felt that he had supplied the promotion with a number of new Japanese trainees due to his success, .. something that he would later have, that Toriumon would later have heat with Asai for a decade later, which I just thought was very funny. Before Asai leaves, you know, they're a relative box office success, but that is at the end of 91. And then you can see in 1992 that the promotion goes downhill. And then in 1993, they have a few Cork and Hall shows that are quite honestly sad. You know, starting in March of 93, so I guess it's just March and June, because they run two tours in the spring and summer. The TV listing that Japanese cable would have used at the time, because it was pre-Gaiora, so it was Japanese cable TV, they are part Hamada's Universal, part Michinoku Pro TV, because at that point the roster is just the Michinoku Pro guys and like two or three luchadors, in the same way that Dragon Gate USA became Evolve with one or two Dragon Gate guys.
Yeah, and it's just I just think it's like interesting the way that like part of like Asai having that easy jumping spot, like as a little tangent, you have Asai basically filling in a void that was created because AAA happened, just as UWA. So like almost all of these things end up being interconnected in a way that I don't think we have had like such like interconnection within wrestling in a lot of different ways since then.
The point that Dave made on Observer Radio this weekend, as Brian Alvarez waited impatiently for him to finish his monologue, just an all-time phoning it in performance from Brian Alvarez there. But Dave made the good point that as Hamada moved into Michinoku Pro, he wasn't the old guy on the roster that forced everybody to slow down. even at this point now, 20, 25 years into his career, and a guy that was approaching 50, you know, he's beat for beat with Delphin, with Togo, with Funaki, and with Takamichinoku, and is in some of the best multi-man matches, and in some of those multi-man matches is the best wrestler in the match. You know, I wanted to be sure to shout out 12-16-96, which obviously is the best Michinoku Pro match of all time, and it's sort of, you know, the quintessential Hamada performance. I compared it to John Elway winning a Super Bowl in his final game, because if Hamada's career ends there, it's the most victorious finale you could possibly imagine. And it's really incredible that even in a Michinoku Pro, that he's able to deliver at that level. Like, if you were looking at the Michinoku Pro roster, you know, and them wrestling from the neck down, because obviously Hamada by that point had aged quite a bit, but if you're looking at them from the neck down, you would think Hamada is just another 27-year-old that is pushing wrestling forward in ways that we're still feeling today, but instead he's 47 doing it.
Case, arguably, Hamada's in the best shape out of anyone in 1996 Michinoku Pro.
Yes.
Like, easily better. If you look at the Sekigun side, you have the fact that Delphin sometimes was able to kind of pop the top off, but you had Hamada out there, and you're absolutely right. Like, you look at it from the waist down, you'd be like, all right, you have all these crazy characters, and that guy looks like the pro wrestler, and it's, oh, wait, that's someone who's almost 50, has been wrestling essentially his whole adult life, and these are all of his students who are now kind of taken over and far exceeded him, but he's the best one working amongst all of them at that time.
Yeah, it would have been interesting had Ultimo never gotten hurt if the early days of Toriumon mirrored Hamada in Michinoku Pro. And that's one of those unanswerable questions we'll never be able to know. But that feels like the blueprint. Not only, obviously, there's the student-teacher connection there, but just implementing, for lack of a better term, an old guy into a young promotion is not an easy thing to do. You know, aesthetically, Hamada could have felt very out of place, but for some reason it worked. In ring, he could have felt very out of place, but for some reason it worked. And again, he ends up making that promotion better, because 1995 Michinoku Pro is good because it's Michinoku Pro, but it's not this incredible year that 94 was, or that 96 was, with the implementation of Hamada. And then, as you know, they finish that decade, you know, the promotion becomes a mess for a variety of reasons. But the fact that he's able to finish his career in the golden era of Michinoku Pro, again, UWA in the 70s, Universal really changing the landscape of Japanese wrestling in the early 90s, and then Michinoku Pro having a legitimate global impact in the mid to late 90s. And, you know, at that point, we get to Toriumon and Dragon Gate, and here we are today.
Yeah, it's really kind of a remarkable life and a real one of one kind of figure that sadly on Saturday we lost. But Case, we both kind of decided two matches we wanted to talk about today from Grand Hamada. We've done a lot of hours on them, but we both picked two different separate ones. And I think let's go with the Universal Lucha Libre 1990 match first, the one with the Grand Hamada, Black Man, and Kendo versus Los Brazos from November 17th, 1990. Case, I'll admit I have not seen this one before, this match, and it was the most fun wrestling match I've like seen in weeks.
That's the thing. It's one of the most fun matches there is. This was not on YouTube when I checked for it, so I downloaded it from the stash that I had of Universal stuff, and I put this on YouTube. So I'll share this link in the Discord. It'll also be in the episode description, but it is, like you said, it's Los Brazos versus Black Man, Grand Hamada, and Kendo from November 17th, 1990. And I think one of the reasons that I've sort of dove into as much classic lucha footage as I have lately is that, you know, any smart person could realize that, hey, wrestling in 2025 is dangerously homogenous. You know, there's very few people doing things that feel innovative and that feel fresh and that feel different. You know, unfortunately, there's not a giant difference right now between a Dragon Gate show and a New Japan show and an AEW show. And that's just something that bothers me to a tremendous degree. I've become obsessed with watching Los Brazos footage because no one, and I mean no one, is doing anything close to what they were doing. And it doesn't always hit. Sometimes they look their weight, you know, sometimes they look lazy, sometimes the footage I've watched has been a little too comedic for my liking, but then there are matches like this where I'm not sure if this could ever happen in America from a sociological standpoint of just America's views on weight. I'm not sure they would ever be able to fully embrace, say, El Brazo.
Yeah.
You know, hypothetically. But this is a match that showcases, one, just how electric those guys are. But you see Hamada, and it's the same thing I took away from the match that you're going to talk about in just a second. Hamada's ability to adapt, whether it was Tiger Mask in New Japan in the early 80s, whether it was Perro Aguayo at any point in his career, or whether it was somebody like these bigger Brazos brothers, where he's literally bouncing off of them at points in this match, sometimes offensively and sometimes as he's taking the offense from the Brazos. It's just, it is the most fun that wrestling can be. It's a match that has a ton of moves. I would argue moves with a Z, but they all seem to flow together so nicely. It is a complete departure from anything that we're seeing in 2025. And whenever I watch footage like this, I always try to think about Gran Akuma and how I think the flagship a few years ago, they were talking about T2P and they're like, man, you know, nobody does the style anymore. And Akuma, who's trained with Skyda, was like, yeah, because it's fucking hard. Like, there's only so many people that know how to teach it, and then there's only so many people that can do it after they've been taught it.
Right.
And I'm trying to remind myself of that as I watch a lot of Super Porky and Brazo de Oro and El Brazo, and then obviously a lot of Hamada, where it's like this style has gone extinct. You know, I don't see it in Mexico. Certainly the Stuka Juniors and the Ultimo Guerrero types are doing some version of this, and the Templarios and Mascara Doradas and Neons and Mysticos are certainly holding up their end of the bargain, but it's not this. And I think if you watch this match, I would assume most people listening have not seen this match. Again, I put it up on YouTube. It's going to be super easy to find. I just take 15 minutes and watch this match because there's just not this anymore. And I don't know if we'll ever get this back. This truly does feel like a dead style.
It's just genius stuff. And you know what really encapsulates the dead style? And some of this is, I don't think that this can work 35 years later, but at this day and age, it is exactly what the Cork and Hall crowd wanted. Boastful, proud heels.
Yep.
Like, the whole conceit of the Brazos being completely insulted by the fact that Kendo gets more chance than they do, that they try to storm out and they keep on going on it, and you have Brazo just cursing up a storm and getting the crowd to try to, instead of chanting Kendo, chanting Spanish curse words instead. And it's just like a meld of styles. Plato is a madman in this. Like, I'm sorry, the way that they build up to his finish in this match is, it is one of the magical things about the trio, the Mexican trios 2 out of 3 falls style, that it's really built up each fall to, oh, his finish happens and he comes off the top rope and you're like, oh my God. Yeah, no, absolutely. This guy, we saw him first, like, threatened to dive. Then he comes off the apron. Then he actually does a full on taupe. And then now he's coming off the top. It's just kind of like the steps in wrestling that you just don't see anymore. And you contrast that, like, even people like Black Men, like, doing like his crazy flying headbutt. And it is just like a style in a way that works, and talking about how Universal was so kind of like ahead of it all at this point. Case, the one thing I would say that felt most 2025 about this is how engaged the crowd was and was for all of it throughout the match. That is, if you drop in 2016 Dragon Gate, like, that is like the through line right there in a lot
of
ways.
Would you say, like, rooting for the promotion instead of any specific wrestler?
Well, I mean, I feel like there's a level of that. I think that more so there's like a willingness to like get involved into the experience that happens, that,
yeah,
be going along with the wrestlers. I mean, it, obviously in 1990, in Universal, you still had all of the great UWA wrestlers coming through it at that time. But really, like, the people that I would say that the crowd was most for throughout the match was Kendo throughout it.
Well, Kendo is fucking awesome.
Yeah,
and
it's incredible how he is in this.
And it's kind of like, we talk about the lack of Hamada footage that we have, but we still have so much. And I did think as I was watching this, oh man, I wish we had another 30 Kendo matches on tape. I feel like it would drastically shape the way that we think about him as a historical all-time great. Because there's just not a lot out there. You know, he works a lot of Universal. He works a little bit of Michinoku Pro. But I feel like we have more of Kendo in Japan than we do in Mexico. Now, I could be off base on that, but I certainly don't feel like I'm coming across a ton of Kendo in Mexico footage.
No, and I know that Kendo is kind of a unique figure within Lucha Libre. Like, he was someone that did not, that just, like, he was a UWA guy, so you have that issue. Then also, I know that, like, then he moved to the States at a certain point, too.
Well, because he pops up on that Dragon Gate LA show.
Right, yeah, but that's because he was based in Southern California, yeah, or close thereabouts. So, like, I wonder at, like, one time, is the footage that you're going to be looking for the guy, and I'm showing my ignorance about Kendo right here, is it going to be the LA Lucha Libre shows of the 90s into the 2000s?
Yeah, he is UWA, obviously, from 84, and then...
He doesn't make it to... Does he make it to the 95 with UWA? I don't think he does.
The last date Cage Match has is the end of 94.
Yeah, I didn't think he made it to that last anniversary show.
And then it looks like he's got one CMLL match, which might have been filmed, which I now need to look up to see if that made tape. And then he's got AAA footage a little bit. It looks like he might have some AAA on TV in 95. What gimmick was he working under at this point?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's
Ninja,
the thing.
Ninja de Fuego.
I knew he changed gimmicks, and I thought that was the thing that I wasn't necessarily certain about.
Okay, and then he's got a bunch of CMLL footage as we okay, this is the stuff that I haven't seen, is him as Ninja de Fuego from like 97 to 02 in CMLL. That's a complete blind spot for me. I haven't seen any of that because I didn't know that he was working under that gimmick. So that will change.
Then why did I think he was in Los Angeles in the
90s? After 02, he moved to LA.
Okay. All right. So I was a decade off.
Yeah, and then he's in Michinoku Pro more than I realized. He works there pretty consistently through 96, but again as Ninja de Fuego, which I did not realize. I thought he was Kendo for his entire Michinoku run, but it looks like in 1996 he's Ninja de Fuego. So that's good to know. I did not realize that. But yeah, Kendo is incredible. Hamada, you know, one of the things that I think is really missing from American wrestling right now, and you tell me if this resonates with you or not. I think we are missing signature babyface comebacks to like a tremendous degree. And not that I want everybody to do the John Cena Five Moves of Doom thing, sure, but there is inherent charm and excitement when you watch a Hamada match and he does the backdrop flip out. Mm-hmm. And then he gets put in the full Nelson and he drops his knee down and he rolls somebody out of the full Nelson. And then he does like a drop kick after that. Like, you know, his comeback beat by beat in the same way that, you know, Ultimo and his babyface comeback beat by beat. Like, I always say, I feel like I could have a match with Ultimo because I know exactly what he's going to mm-hmm. do. I don't think there's a lot of people doing that in wrestling right now. And when you watch the Hamada match against the Los Brazos, the start of the second fall is this Hamada babyface comeback that, one, you could put on any wrestling company in 2025, it would blow people away. But two, it's just like, why is this not a thing? How did we get away from one of the most basic components of wrestling there is, which is this signature beat by beat babyface comeback? I just don't feel like I'm seeing that now.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. There's no one in AEW has a babyface comeback.
No,
I mean, Kenny kind of has it's like V trigger.
And like in the Terminator dive, which is kind of what I'm looking for, but I feel like he should have like four or five moves before that dive that should just be the same every time.
Yeah, no. Instead, you really have that towards the end where he starts spamming V triggers before hitting the One Wing Angel.
Like, yeah,
like kind of that, but that's not a five moves of doom whatsoever.
It's not to get on my high horse here. Will Ospreay and Kyle Fletcher is not only a tremendous wrestling feud. It is, I think it is one of the signature feuds in AEW history at this point. I am so into it. I think it's so great. I don't want to sound like Matt D when I say this. I loved the Grand Slam Australia tag, and at the same time, I thought the structure of that match was a mess. I thought it was a great match in spite of it being laid out in a way that I couldn't believe the way they were laying it out, because I thought it would be, they beat the piss out of Kenny, And then Will would have a, at that point, signature babyface comeback. And then you would see, you know, the essentially new mega powers do their thing and get the win. The finish was awesome. The structure of that match I thought was a disaster, and they just all happened to be so good that I still ended up liking it. But if we're going to see more Kenny and Ospreay tags, I would like to see Kenny sell. And then I would like for Ospreay, for instance, to have a babyface comeback where we know every move ahead of time. I just feel like that's missing in wrestling right now.
No, it definitely feels like that. And especially the more you kind of watch Hamada, it's very clear. Like, as soon as you, like, at a certain point, you're like, oh no, he's getting tagged in. He's going to be doing the backflip, and then he's going to come in with the dropkick, and then likely leading up to the Rana hole.
And again, you know, that's the highlight of a lot of those Michinoku Pro matches is Hamada's hot tag. And so it's not, you know, I think, you know, maybe just being in the time period we are in the country we're in, maybe the John Cena effect has tainted that a little bit, where it's like, oh, five moves of doom. But no, that's good. I'll take one of those if we can have 100 really interesting ones also.
Right, yeah. And I think that you talked about the adaptability of Hamada. The Universal match very much was, all right, we're going to plug into the Brazos format, but doing it in a hot crowd as the easy technicos. The match I chose for you was a little bit different. It was what happens when Hamada gets tossed into a match against absolutely out of his mind 1992 Negro Casas. And boy, was that kind of a different display in how great Hamada was.
Two of the things that I wasn't able to include in the article because I couldn't find a place for them was, one, Dave mentions in an early 1990 Observer that Shinma and Hamada were aggressively approaching Tatsumi Fujinami to join Universal. There's no discussion to be had there other than that I thought it was super interesting. The other one is, in 1992, Dave wrote about how Hamada and Negro Casas had heat from a Universal tour, and that's why Casa stopped working Universal. But I was searching all over, I could never figure out what the impetus of the issue was. But I had that in the back of my head as I rewatched this match of, yeah, Hamada and Casas, two guys known for working at 100 miles an hour, kind of worked this match at 110 miles an hour.
Yeah, and you had that around the Cowboys, who I really, that has been one of my joys. And
they are fucking, they, Los Cowboys, El Tejano and Silver King, they could have, if they came around 10 years later, they could have been in Noah's junior division with Kenta and Marufuji at their peak. They could have been in Toriumon. They would have fit, I guess, into Osaka Pro, although they were probably far too serious to be in Osaka Pro. They could have fit into CMLL with Ultimo Guerrero and Rey Bucanero, and, you know, the early stages of Místico and you know, him and Santo teaming. That team, more than any team I can ever think of, was 10 years too early, because they are absolutely amazing.
Imagine them versus Wrecking Crew in 2002 Ring of Honor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you had so much there that you kind of have several matches happening at the same time. You have Casas, and so this match, I'll include this in the show notes. It's February 16th, 1992. Rambo, Negro Casas, and Dr. Wagner Jr. versus Gran Hamada, Silver King, and Tejano. You have multiple kind of things happening in this match at the same time. You have Rambo and Negro Casas not being on the same page, and it almost completely backfiring on the match throughout it. You have Wagner, who busts open Hamada. He wrecks him with like one forearm, and Hamada essentially has to take like a 2-minute break throughout the match because I had to make sure that he was all right with that. And then you have the Los Cowboys, who just they're the ones that kind of come on in the segunda and tercera, who just are just terminators in a way that is just so fun, seeing guys of a relative size work in that kind of manner. And you have an interesting DQ that, you know, I mean, it's 1992 in Mexico. What counts as a DQ? Well, doing a guillotine, dropping someone across a barricade, apparently does.
Yeah. As somebody who went through 1993 AAA, every once in a while, you just have to throw your hands up at a finish and go, maybe it's a cultural thing. I don't know. I don't understand what just happened.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, you know what? That sucks. I could see that being a DQ. Like,
yeah. And I go, man, I feel like I understand wrestling really well. I don't know what just happened. Interesting. Okay, moving on.
Yeah, and like, the one thing I really like about UWA 92 footage, a lot of the footage is in Toreo where they have multiple hard cams.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to kind of get to see the entire bull ring throughout the match. And you do have the situation, two referees, and there's a lot of two referee kind of distractions happening throughout this match. And I just think that it's really just an inventive match. Like the Segunda finish is one of the more inventive finishes I feel like I've seen in a trios match, where the technicos basically start the problem with Rombo and Casas, where they basically have Casas do a Rana to Rombo, and then they fold them back and forth to get both of the falls. And it's just a cool match to me. Like, I really enjoyed watching it the first time and revisiting it. It is not always like the best of Hamada, but it's him in a different kind of style that I feel like doesn't always get mentioned when you talk about Grand Hamada.
So I really want people to watch that match, because if you're somebody who has any sort of lucha hang up, whether it be you don't like the style or you're unfamiliar with the guys, this is a good match to watch, because it's Hamada, who, if you're listening to this, I'm sure you're safe with, and then Tejano and Silver King. So you're good there. That side is all going to work for you. And then the Rudo side is Dr. Wagner Jr., who, you know, would do time in New Japan and fits in that environment really well. There's actually a great Dr. Wagner Jr. Grand Hamada singles match at Universal, yeah, that I linked in my article. That's mm-hmm. really, really good. Negro Casas, who was the most lucha friendly person for not lucha fans, you know, phenomenal wrestler. What is your experience level with Rombo?
Only through the UWA 92 footage. And
okay, what do you make of him? I'm curious, because he's in 1993 AAA, so I've actually mm-hmm. watched a ton of him recently. What are your thoughts on him?
I mean, sometimes you need a sleaze guy. And the Rudos, mm-hmm. and that very much like it kind of like works and emulates in the way that you would have like La Peste Negra happening with Negro Casas later in the 2000s. You know, it's like, yeah, no, Rombo's a guy who should be teaming with Negro Casas. Let it be 1992 or 2022.
So he really works in this match, because for as good as Casas and Hamada are together, I was actually more entertained by Hamada and Rombo together, just because it's like Hamada turning water into wine. You know, it's just like, God, he's getting this out of that guy. That's astounding. I can't believe that. Rombo in 1993 AAA is interesting, because he comes in and kind of has the Cyber Kong effect, where whenever he's on the screen, I go, fuck, I don't want to watch this right now. What am I doing with my life? But there's a charm to him that comes out, and I just watched, he has a hair versus mask match with him in Viano 3, where Rombo takes some of the most sickening bumps I have ever seen in that match.
He's the guy who will take the crazy bumps. He's the one that's willing to get guillotined. He is needed to have in these matches.
Yeah, he really sacrifices his body in that match, and Viano is kind of a guy that I'm hyper fixated on right now. I really, as it's 2025 and I'm going, well, you know, should I have a greatest wrestler ever bout in 2026? Maybe I'll just do one myself just for the sake of, you know, the 10-year mark of 2016. And obviously if I submit it, if I have one, if I put together one in 2026, it's going to be much more lucha heavy than 2016, when I think I just had Casas on the ballot. And then in 2021, where I would have had Hamada and Santo and Casas, and I think I bumped Fuerza Guerrera at the last second. But Viano 3 would be one of the guys that I would consider for, you know, top 100 wrestlers of all time. And Viano is so incredible, but Rombo really makes that match, because he is so giving with his body, and he takes such sickening bumps. And it's not quite as violent with Hamada, but you can see that, like, this guy was game to do stuff. It's really... If you watch him in the right setting, he's actually an incredibly charming wrestler.
Yeah, and I feel like in this match, especially, like, playing off of Casas and their miscommunications, you know, like, you need to kind of have a goof in that position. And I've seen enough of, like, 92 Rombo where I'm like, okay, you know, like, he's there. But Yeah, no, I can get Howell 93, especially with Pena, that can get.
The Viano match is really good. That's, and I'm not breaking any ground there. It's, you know, it's of the 1993 AAA stuff. It's kind of considered to be one of the high-end matches, but it really is good. It's a really violent match in terms of not even, you know, the punch kick brawl stuff and the mask ripping, but just some of the bumps they take towards the finish are pretty jarring. It's really enjoyable. But he's awesome here. You know, it's you know, another one of those places where you can just put Hamada into a year, and whether it's Casas or Pero or, you know, later Sasuke and Takemichinoku and whoever, you know, he always found a way to thrive in those environments. I think he is one of the most important wrestlers there is in terms of understanding modern wrestling history. You know, I wrote at the end of the article, you know, it would be impossible to say what wrestling would look like without Hamada, but I'm glad we'll never know, because this is a guy who, again, was the focal point for three pretty different revolutionary promotions. And I don't know a lot of other people that can say that. And so, you know, I'm glad that, you know, we've spent as much time on him as we have over the last few years, you know, between the shows with Alan. And, you know, I really fell in love with all that Universal footage when I discovered it. And I know we talked about that a lot at the time, you know, sort of as we were exiting the pandemic and had a little bit more time to talk about some things. And, you know, Dragon Gate, you know, would have off weeks, and we talk about Hamada Universal. And then we had the Cub show last year, and then obviously tonight. You know, it's just, it's the first major death that I think the Dragon system has had. And it's not going to get any easier, but hopefully we can prolong, you know, having another conversation like this for quite a while. But, you know, Grand Hamada, one of the all-time greats. I have him as one of the 50 greatest wrestlers. I think you have him in the top 25, maybe.
I had him at 11 in 20.
Yeah, and I don't have an argument against that. You know, I had him in my low 40s. You know, I think at like 40, I had him at 42. And if I was going to do another ballot today, he'd fit somewhere between like 42 and 35. You know, I'm not sure I would bump him up a ton, but we're talking about a guy who is one of the 100 greatest wrestlers of all time. I think any sensible person would say that. One of the most innovative wrestlers of all time, one of the most influential wrestlers of all time, at a time where I think influence is sometimes being wielded in directions where it doesn't deserve it. Hamada is the definition of influential, and sadly, it might take a death bump to get him in. But if you are an Observer Hall of Fame an Observer Hall of Fame voter, I would really encourage you to vote for him this next year. I think I'm going to vote in Mexico this year. I think I'm at a point where I feel comfortable voting in Mexico. And obviously, if I do that, Hamada will be on my ballot.
Yeah, I feel like that if I were, I would too. You know, just because, like, I feel like over the last decade, maybe outside of Dragon Gate, the stuff I watch more of and I've enjoyed most has been Lucha, and getting into the history and being able to, like, listen to people talk about it. And then also some of the events that have happened that have encouraged me to kind of push backwards even more. I feel like that this year should be the year. I mean, it's a shame that it would take a death bump, but I mean, pro wrestling today wouldn't look like the way it does now without Gran Hamada.
Well said. The only other thing I'll add is on my Twitter, I've been retweeting kind of all the tweets that I've seen come in from other wrestlers. You know, Super Delphin had a very nice tweet about him. Susumu Yokosuka had a very nice tweet about him. My favorite, I don't know if you saw this. If you didn't, please go to my Twitter real quick. Did you see the Brother Yoshi tribute post?
Oh, not yet, but I am. How quickly am I finishing that autocomplete to get to that?
It is Brother Yoshi and Grand Hamada and somebody else in Mexico in 2019, and Yoshi is talking about how much Hamada loved his cigarettes, and it is such a charming photo of those individuals.
Oh, God.
I wouldn't want to be remembered any other way.
Yeah, God. Yeah, no, I'm seeing the photo now, too. And Hamada could hang with any of them. You know?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I think Tajiri, because Tajiri's had a bunch of tweets which have been interesting. Mm-hmm. Somebody,
Tajiri's book is interesting in a lot of ways.
Tajiri is a very interesting guy. It's funny, you know. Again, I wanted to talk DDT, and I actually wanted to talk about Tajiri on this podcast this week, and then we obviously got sidetracked with the Hamada stuff. But somebody said something about, like, Hamada never wanted to talk about wrestling. He only wanted to talk about attractive women. Something along those lines. That was just very, very funny. Very old guy. Like, ah, look at this guy over here.
Yeah. So, Case, one of the things that I've been doing a lot of, like, I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks, a lot of audiobook mysteries, and one of the audiobook mystery series that I really enjoy is about a bunch of retirees in England solving murders.
Oh, and good Lord. Okay, all right. I'm trying to keep up.
Yeah. It's called the Thursday Murder Club. And like just from like all these like random wrestler things, I'm like, oh yeah, no, Gran Hamada should have been a detective. I could see that. I mean, no, doesn't want to talk about the wrestling, rather would just talk about the lady that walked by.
Of course. Oh, real quick before we move on to Dragon Gate, I have to mention this. Shout out Griffin Peltier. His YouTube channel, if you're not following it, is the best YouTube channel there is. It's Hollywood's Wrestling Rewind without the two O's on the back end of Hollywood. So HOLLYWD'S Wrestling Rewind. One, today he put up he's doing a bunch of compilations. So it's like Negro Casas in WWF, which was a super enjoyable one. It was all the Torimon matches in WCW, which was a super enjoyable one. He put up Team Dragon Gate and Wrestling Society X today.
Oh boy.
Which I have not had the chance to get to, but credit to him. He put together the Tajiri on Velocity comp, which is all of Tajiri's matches on Velocity.
It is over 3 hours long.
And it's worth every second of. I cannot recommend this enough. Tajiri, I tried to post this on Twitter, but I couldn't really figure out how to phrase it exactly how I wanted to. Tajiri is the greatest wrestler ever with the fewest great matches. Like, there's very few four-star Tajiri matches. It's like a few of the ECW three-ways.
Okay.
Does he wrestle Otani at the 98 Dome? He's got, like, a Dome match that's really good right before he leaves for America. And then it's just, he is everything that people say Matt Hardy is. Now, look, I also think Matt Hardy has a number of really good TV matches in the early 2000s. Tajiri's TV matches are on another fucking level. I cannot recommend, just put it on, and you're going to get distracted by it. All of these matches, Tajiri versus Billy Kidman, Tajiri versus Crash Holly, there's so many great.
Velocity was great.
It was fantastic. There's like so many great, like 7 to 8 minute matches. I keep on going back to it and I'm watching like a half hour at a time. And every time I put it on, you know, it's three or four matches that I can fit in. And every time I'm just blown away by it. So thank you to Griffin for doing that. Griffin's YouTube channel is awesome. The Torimon and WCW Supercut is incredible, but the Tajiri on Velocity one is the best thing he's posted.
I mean, he also, I know the channel. I'm now going through some of the ones. He does have Stalker at Chicago in the US Indies.
Yes, he does. And he put a ton of work into that, trying to track down some Stalker matches that appear to have not made tape from the US Indies. But it's such an awesome channel. I love it. The Super Astro stuff he put on there is great. He's, you know, found a bunch of ECW footage that he's put on there, but Tajiri on Velocity is, I cannot recommend it enough. It is so, so awesome.
And for any old Everything Elite heads, he does have Fubu Andre's dark matchup or supercut from All Elite Wrestling Daily's Place.
All right, Mike, we've got about a half hour left. Yeah, you want to talk about Dragon Gate for a half hour?
Yeah, let's talk about Dragon Gate for a half hour. So they ran Hakata during the holiday on last Tuesday. Of course, last Tuesday we had our show with HoHo Balloon. Thanks for HoHo for stopping by for that. And they had their first Hakata doubleheader of the year based around basically, I would say, setting up the two larger weekends coming up for Dragon Gate. The Memorial Gate card, we now have the full card, but it was really the focus of the evening session. And then we also have the main event for March 1st at Osaka 2. Champion Gate is not being referred to as Champion Gate anymore, but it's Yamato versus KZ coming out of the first night. And Case, it was an interesting day in Hakata. And I would say, like, in comparison to past Hakata days, it's usually the evening show that is the stronger from a work rate standpoint. But this time, I found myself really enjoying the afternoon a lot more.
The first show, the afternoon one, is an awesome start to finish show. I would watch everything on that first show and only the main event on the second show.
Yeah, I would say on the evening, it is the main event, really. You don't, the three match series that they did to set the Triangle Gate was good in theory, but not exceptional, I would say. But the main event, the Gold Class versus Shun, Jason Lee, Kota Minoru, and Hamari main event. I thought this, like, I feel like the best way to kind of talk about this day is kind of hop around and talk about guys with it. I thought Hamari had a strong Hakata last week.
I could not agree more. Let's talk about it. I've got to spring a topic on you here. It's easy. You're exactly right. My big takeaway was that Hamari had an awesome weekend. And like, it made me go like, oh, that's right. This guy's awesome. You know, and they're doing something interesting with him in the way that they're approaching all of his matches and the fact that, you know, he's taking a lot of shortcuts, which is very intentional. And I think what they've done has been very interesting. Sometimes it falls under the definition of more interesting than good. And he was just straight up good on these two shows. I have a list of wrestlers that did not make Voices of Wrestling's 30 under 30 last year.
The controversial 30 under 30.
Very controversial. I've many of Voices of Wrestling Slack fights have emerged in the fallout of this 30 under 30, including me telling somebody to fuck off forever a few weeks ago. That was loosely based on the 30 under 30 conversation. But last year it was Kame finishing 24th, Junior finishing 23rd, and Shun finishing 4th. I'm going to rattle off a list of guys that are eligible for 30 under 30 this year. All you have to do is tell me, would you consider voting for them?
Okay, yeah.
Ishin.
Yes, easily.
Yoshiki Kato.
Yes.
Akihiro Sahara.
No.
Interesting.
I just doesn't have enough ring time.
I think I'd put the Dreamgate belt on Sahara if they let me right now.
I mean, like, if we're talking, if 30 under 30 was a November thing and not a May thing, yes. But we've only seen virtually 4 months of his career and maybe 10 televised matches.
He's so good now. Like, it's actually insane how good he is.
It's so clear that he's going to be a guy. And in a different way than Kato, you know?
Yes, exactly. That's the interesting thing with Ishin and Kato and Sahara is that they have prominent heavyweights who are all super different from each other, which is just, it's a very interesting thing as we go along with these guys' careers. Sahara is bringing the best out of Kai, which I think might qualify him for 30 under 30 on that alone.
That is true. They had a great slap fight.
And they've had awesome chemistry every time they've wrestled. It's becoming a little bit like Kai and UT, where the real heads know, like, hey, those guys are, they kill it with each other. Kai and Sahara are sort of the same boat. So you would say yes to Ishin, yes to Kato, no to Sahara. Daiki Yanagiuchi.
Yes.
Yeah, I think he's a guy this year. Yeah.
Really good on this show.
He's just really good. And I think what will swing that? I think an entire voting base is gonna wait for that March Corkin show. And if the Rey de Parejas match with him and Kato is as good as we all hope it will be, I think Yanagiuchi is gonna earn his way onto a lot of people's ballots with that.
I think that's fair.
Because he's missing the high end match. I spent the weekend with DDT. And really enjoyed some of it, and it made me go like, oh, there's DDT guys I have to vote for now.
Keigo Nakamura?
Yes. Yes, yeah. There's a plethora of CMLL guys. Okay, that's good, because Keigo is who I want to talk about, because
I saw Keigo recently on The Glade Show, so yeah.
Whew, Jesus. Okay. Well, we're not doing that. We're not talking about this, but
I'm saying I've seen him recently, both him and Kazuma Sumi. Yeah.
Let's not muck up the Grand Hamada Memorial Show with Glade Talk, okay? Is that fair?
Hey, I was very lucky. The good, the bad, and the hungry. Tyler and Fred had me on to talk about Grand Slam, and we did a half hour on Glate that Fred somehow got me to accidentally cancel my membership. I can't restart it until it technically expires. YouTube has confused me too much.
Oh, that's good stuff.
That Keigo Nakamura, yes, he would be on mine. Yeah.
Yeah, just there's DDT guys. There's obviously a bunch of CMLL guys. New Japan, credit to them, knocked out of the park a new beginning in Osaka. So there's, now look, you,
Fujita, yeah.
And obviously, you know, I think Suji might be 30 now, but Oiwa's there. You won't find me voting for fucking Yuya Uemura. Let me tell you that guy's not it. That guy is the next Sonata.
I just feel like he comes off like a big nerd.
I think he sucks. And, yeah. You know, if you look at last year, Umino finished in the top 10.
That ain't happening this year.
I don't know how people could vote for him. Now, look, not everybody's going to be tuned in Drangate. Not everybody's going to be tuned in to CMLL. The spots open up quickly if you're not in on those two promotions. But I didn't vote for him last year because I thought he sucked then. But, I mean, you can't vote for him in the top 10 this year.
No, I don't think, at least I feel like you'd be lying to yourself if you had him in the top 20. Like
I'm with you.
You can find a 25 through 30 for him, but I can't see him, at least me personally. I can name 25 wrestlers under the age of 30 that I think are more promising than Shota Umino easily.
Ryu Fuda.
No.
He would not be my 50 under 30. I don't think that's happening with him.
No, I think he was going to end up like OG if we go 5 years down the line.
It's
sad because he's not bad.
He's not bad, but you just can't help but notice that, okay, they put him and Daiki together, and Daiki immediately has the best matches of his career. And then they add Sahara to the mix, and all of a sudden Sahara is like this runaway freight train. And you know who's still in the same place that he was 6 months ago? Ryo Fuda.
I mean, he has a theme song that they let them all come out to, so there's that.
Now there is that. What about Hamare?
Man, Hamare is like the interesting question because I see him, and especially the performance he had this week, he bumps like a maniac. Mm-hmm. Like, this guy is a slinky, and his spine might be one too. And he's starting to kind of, we're seeing the steps in the offense. I know Jay has made a point about, like, oh, Hamare has kind of been a dive in, do the corner cutter and super kick kind of guy, but not a whole lot else there. But we've seen, at least I felt like in his match with Hio, especially on the afternoon show, we got to see a lot of, I probably would say Hamare, I would have Hamare in the 26 through 30 right now, just because of how they are very pointed about how he is getting treated. Do I think he is better than like Daiki Yanagiuchi, like 5 years down the line? Easily. But for like right now on February 18th, 2025, I would have Daiki above Hamare. Yeah.
If you're voting on potential, at least as one of the qualifiers, Hamare becomes really hard to ignore. The bummer with him is that he only gets one Rey de Parejas match on TV, and it's him and Shun against Hyo and Jiro. And I'm not seeing that swaying the vote. I don't think that's going to rock the vote for Hamare.
No, he's not going to have the opportunity to really do a full accounting of himself. I mean, the thing that really hurts him in this kind of balloting situation case is entirely the way he was booked for Young Dragon's Cup, like, which was very intentional and makes sense for what they were trying to do. But and when you're like looking and you're comparing wrestlers across the world and under the age of 30, you have someone now that is, 20, but what we've seen versus, even like Sahara, you know, Sahara, we have seen a lot more of actual like ringsmanship, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. And that will be an issue for some voters for Hamare. It won't be for me. He's still in my 30, but I can see why it's not.
Let me ask you a few quick ones real quick. What about Hio?
Hio? Yeah. Oh, easily. Yeah.
He's the one I struggled with most last year. I don't know what to do with him.
He's just a charisma monster. You just kind of have to let him do it. My thing is that I hope he doesn't get too high off his own supply, and then goes to Uptown, you know?
Is it offensive to call Hio Dragon Gate's Jey Uso?
I've not seen a Jey Uso match in the greater part of the last 7 years. So,
no, I watched the match with his brother last year because it was so bad that I laughed at it. But yeah,
I don't need a touch poop to know it's poop.
Dragon Daya.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would not have said that at this time last year. Ryoya Tanaka.
Tanaka is a yes, but I think he would be towards the back half.
Okay, I will be for sure voting for Tanaka again. And then he was hurt when we did the voting last year. What about Rita?
Oh, Rita, yeah, absolutely.
Yep. With you. I think I will have Rita and Junior annoyingly high.
And I just want to verify this case. Shun Skywalker's birthday this year is, oh great, he's only a 96, not a 95. Yep, no, we actually have two more years of Shun Skywalker in this.
Yeah, I
that's gonna drive some people insane.
Oh, I mean, he'll be my number one, and unless maybe Kyle Fletcher, because I really do think he's doing good work.
Here's
the thing with Shun, because I can tie this back into Fukuoka, is I thought Shun was one of the five best wrestlers in the world last year because he found a way to reinvent himself where he was almost like a wrestler doing a lounge act in a really interesting and inspired way, where we had, you know, like 2021 era Shun, Masquerade Shun, was just outright great match after great match after great match. And last year, the physical effort was down, but the end result was still so similar, where it was like, oh my God, this guy, you know, again, I always go back to the match with Okan and Bushi, where he was otherworldly in that match. And it maybe wasn't a technically great match, but Shun was so above and beyond great in that match that I was just left floored by it. What we're seeing here, and it was so evident on these two shows, especially the D-Courage match on the afternoon show, is Shun's just, he's fucking working this year. You know, he is working noticeably harder than he was last year, and I thought he was great last year. And so, yeah, Shun is the guy that needs to be knocked off the top of the mountain.
Yeah, and I feel like that we saw, especially in that D-Courage match, I thought that was my match of the day, I guess I would say, across the two. And I think that one of the reasons why I loved it so much was that you, by that point on the show, most of the overt, over-the-top Z-Brats stuff was already out of the way. Mm-hmm. So what you had instead was like the legit Z-Brats match. And you had that with, I think, the three people on the roster that, if you're picking Shun, Jason Lee, and Kodama Nora, who are the three you want to put up against them? At least as of today, it might change on March 2nd, Case. But at this point, it is Madoka Kakuta, Dragon Dai, and Ryo Tanaka, because I felt like I can't remember a Dragon Gate match that I, quite frankly, when the 10-minute call happened, I was like, really? Was that 10 minutes? Like, this match just kept it on, and then you had like such a smart finish of Z-Brats taking advantage of missed spots and then going straight into murdering Tanaka with the midnight hour into the maximum driver.
I had this at 3 3/4 initially.
I'm but four.
You've talked me into going 4 on this. This is going to go on the spreadsheet. I want to be sure to remember this match come the end of the year. Let me ask you this. If visas weren't an issue,
okay,
and you were obviously booking WrestleMania weekend in Vegas this year, what is the 6-man match that you would do?
I'm glad you asked that, because that was a topic I had in this match notes I wanted to ask you about.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you would want to have a Z-Brats would have to be on one of the sides. And
yes.
I think you would go Shun and Mino Lee, honestly.
Would you go Shun and Mino Lee over Shun, Ishin, and Jason?
I mean, I think if we're talking about a Dragon Gate 6-man at WrestleMania weekend and what all that means, I think Ishin is amazing, and I think he is going to be an absolute terror to crowds in April. But I think for like that kind of match in the standard there, you go Mino Lee over Ishin and Kato, you know?
Who would be the technical side?
It'd be very hard for me not to put this trio of D-Courage. However, the other one that I would think about would probably be Ben, Rita, and Jack.
This is what I was trying to figure out, is I would for sure do Z-Brats in Gold Class.
I guess Ben, Rita, and Zach. And
Jack,
Rita,
yeah.
And Jack, yeah.
I want to get Junior in there, but I think you're right. I think Shun, for me, it would be Shun, Ishin, and Jason against Ben, Rita, and Jack.
You know
that
what I want to
have? That's got to be the match.
Do you know where I would put Junior on this card? Because, yes, he would be getting a Visa and coming over.
Yeah, it's a bummer that he's not in real life. Where would you put him on this card?
We are going to do a complete throwback, and he's going to face John Davis. I think that would rock. I really do think that would rock.
Well, okay, you've become Mr. Deadlock Pro. Who are the Americans that are going to be in Vegas that Dragon Gate should be looking at? Because I can't get a straight answer on who, like, what talent is going to be in Vegas. But I would like to, I would like to be able to like mentally put together some matches here, but all I know is that Mad Dog Connolly's going to be there, which is great. Cool guy, but that doesn't help me for this.
Yeah. Mad Dog Connolly, unless we're bringing back DUF.
Like, well, I have an idea for Mad Dog Connolly, but it's I'm gonna table it for now. I'm just wait, who's like the prototypical Drangit USA guy that's gonna be in Vegas?
I mean, like that's kind of the difficult thing because like the people that I would say now have WWID, you know, and they're kind of already that way, and I want to keep that far away from that. I don't think you need to have that fox in the hen house, you know. So. I think LeBron Cazone would work really well against I would like to see him against Asuma Yokosuka.
Okay. He was going to be the one name that I mentioned.
Yeah.
So, okay, we're on the same page. That was a fruitful conversation.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, so, some of the things with, like, Deadlock, like, Jackson Drake, I would think Jackson Drake would have been the guy, but WWID. So that kind of knocks off that one. It would be interesting, but I don't think it would be a DGUSA thing to do Violence is Forever versus KZ and UT.
Oh, that would be fun.
I have ideas. I have a lot of ideas, KZ.
That's good. I like that you have ideas. That's why we do this show. I like it. I'm a big fan. I don't have much more. We had another topic. I'm going to table that because I actually, and you know what it is. Mm-hmm. I think it will still be relevant when we talk about Wakayama next week.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean,
let's preview that real quick.
Yeah, no. That topic, actually, I will save that. I had a bookmark that I was going to bring up about that topic, but we'll be good.
Trust me, it'll apply to Wakayama too.
Yeah. So we have Memorial Gate coming up next Monday from Wakayama Prefectorial Gym. It is the kind of the first of the non A-tier big shows of the year, really. I mean, like, it's kind of has had this position for a long time. We've talked about Wakayama's and past voice gates, but let's just run down the card real quick. We have opening the card, we have Madoka Kakuta and Dragon Daya versus Rita and Jackie Kamei. We have a trios match, Ginki Horiguchi, Izushi Kanda, Sachi Hoko Boy versus Benkei Mochizuki Jr. and Ho-Ho Loon. Singles match, Ryoya Tanaka versus Luis Monte. A Rey de Parejas 2025 skirmish 8-man tag team match. It is Mochizuki Dojo, Masaki Mochizuki, who was not on the Hakata shows, Akihiro Sahara, Ryo Fuda, and Daiki Yanagiuchi versus Z-Brats, Shun Skywalker and his tag team partner Hamari, and the open the Twin Gate champions, Kota Minoru and Jason Lee, Yamato and Hyo versus KZ and UT, kind of previewing that March 1st Dreamgate match in Osaka. And then for the main event, and as the result of the three-match series in the evening portion of Hakata, they open the Triangle Gate Championship match. The champion team Paradox will defend against BB Hulk, Susumu Yokosuka, and Kagetora versus, those are the champions, versus Kai, Ishin, and Yoshiki Kato. For a Memorial Gate card case, yeah, we have like our obligatory title match here, but the pairs that have come together to fill out the rest of the card, we at least have some real fun matchups, I feel like.
I got to give them credit. This is a good-looking show, you know.
Monte versus Tanaka? I'm all for that.
Well, I'm just going to just basically repeat what you just said, but Kakuta and Daya versus Rita and Jack, which I don't think we'll get time, but we'll be fun. Tanaka versus Monte, and then the one that I'm staring at is the Mochizuki Dojo guys versus Shun, Hamari, Kota, and Jason. I mean, that is positioned to where if they have an intermission, which I assume they will, they'll go to intermission after that match. So that should get time, and that should be really good.
Yeah, and KZ and UT, I mean, they had they were a part of the afternoon main event that got KZ his dream key. Nice to see that tag team back, and it's interesting seeing Hyokin kind of plugged into that situation, but with the rest of Paradox and notably no Naruki Doi on the show, you kind of needed to have a super sub, and Hyo's in that position, and I think it'll be fun. I've liked Hyo with UT and KZ, and it'll be interesting to see the chemistry between Yamato and Hyo.
Yeah, I'll save my Yamato KZ thoughts for next week, but I enjoy anytime UT can get in a big match, I enjoy it. And Memorial Gate, I thought the past 2 years was a really weak show, really going back to 2022 when they sort of sacrificed Jason Lee and Estrella in a Twin Gate match that was just doomed from the start. But I'm into this show. As I said in the Voices of Wrestling Discord, it has entered the territory that Gate of Origin is now in, where if I watch the show and really like it, I will review it. If I think the show is anything less than outstanding, I will not write about it, but I obviously will talk about it next week.
Yep, that'll be our plan. We'll be back next week to talk all about that. Case, one last thing that I was going to bring up, Shun Skywalker produce.
Sold out immediately.
In a minute. That was my note about it. Tokyo Sports reported that within a minute it was sold out. And he's mad that Shingo has never faced him at Kobe World. That's the basis behind that match.
Well, that is good to know.
He said, I was reading the Tokyo Sports article that came out a couple hours ago, Case. And Shun was like, yeah, no, in 2018, Shingo Takagi, before he left, said, like, yeah, no, I want to see you back here and I'll face you after you main event Kobe World. And then Shun Skywalker is like, I did that 3 times. So why are you lacking right now?
Yeah. No, that's good stuff. So that show, it's Himare, Kota, and Shun against Bushi, Hiromu, Shingo. Was that the matchup?
Right. Yep. That's the only match announced.
That'll be awesome. I can't wait for that.
Yeah, no. And I mean, doing that immediately there, such a good switch out from, as much as we enjoyed Buyuden and Scrap or Die MMA Rita, this really feels like the right kind of thing for like that. And, you know, they did end up advertising Shingo before tickets went on sale.
Yes, they did. And people in the Discord can tell you to suck it. and that is my last thought on that show.
Yeah. Anything else you want to touch on, bud, before we got
out of here? What's funny is that you beat me in the Discord. You're saying, I don't think that's going to be Shingo. They always advertise Shingo. And then you said it, so I held off. Yeah. It just made you look bad.
Hey, you know. Sometimes that happens.
Oh, but Lore knows I have had many a predictions go astray, but I was just dying. I was like, oh, Mike beat me to that. I was going to say the same thing.
but I turned out to be right in the end. You advertised
Shingo. Yes, you did, because he was not X. You're right.
Yeah, because why would you have Shingo as X? You advertise Shingo.
I agree. I know. Yeah. You were right. I was dying. I was like, oh, fuck it. Fucking glad I was offline for a few hours.
God, I'm not going to go into this, Case, but I hate how much of the latest interviews on Tokyo Sports have involve random people from GLATE that are popping up here, because they just make press all the time.
We are not doing GLATE this week, let me tell you.
Yeah, no, we will not be doing that. Anything else, buddy, before we got out of here?
I don't think so.
Well, you could follow us on social media. We are at Open Voice Gate. You can visit and discuss with us in the Voices of Wrestling Discord. That is where Case has tried to bring a groundswell against me over recent weeks. We have our own channel, the Open the Voice Gate channel, as well as the Dragon Gate channel there as well. We'll post links to the matches, the Hamada matches that we discussed tonight as well. I mentioned it a little bit, but I appeared on Good and Bad and the Hungy this week. Fred and Tyler wanted to have me on to talk about a very interesting kind of Grand Slam Australia card and why people were fixated on rings for whatever reasons, but it was a good time and appreciate it. And thanks for them for inviting me on. Case is at _ in your case. I'm at Fuji Heya. Thanks for listening to Open Voice Gate. We'll be back with you next week talking Memorial Gate. Take care, everyone.
Hello, do you like New Japan Pro Wrestling? Are you a Shin Nihon freak? If so, check out the Super J-Cast with Joel and Damon on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.
And even if you fucking hate New Japan Pro Wrestling, listen to the Super J-Cast anyway. Not just for our great show reviews, analysis, and pastrami sandwiches, but there's also usually some dick jokes somewhere in the obligatory opening 30 minutes of absolute nonsense we chat about every single week. That's the Super J-Cast for all the best talk about New Japan Pro Wrestling, crisps, and pornography.